Podcast, Season 2, with Robert Kyleman and Joshua Britt.
That's correct.
Featuring topics about real estate nobody is talking about.
I need your expertise on it.
The Real Estate Talk Podcast starts now.
All right, Real Estate Talk Podcast, Season 2, Episode, 16?
Yeah. 15?
Yeah, 16 already. Goodness gracious. About to bring some news updates to you. This episode sponsored by Closer Coffee Company. Closer Coffee Company. And welcome back to another Real Estate Talk Podcast. Rob Kyleman.
I'm Joshua Britt.
All right. Guys, we got some updates for you. This is kind of a follow-up of what we updated you before. The personal consumption expenditures, I guess it rose to 2.7%. That was information that came out on Friday. UVM or U-Mortgage under attack for alleged shell scheme. And Biden raising the capital gains to a proposed 44.6%.
It's tough. That's a tough number to swallow for many investors.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but you guys might have noticed we have Closer Coffee Company. This is what this episode is sponsored by, Closer Coffee Company, fresh roasted coffee for closers by closers. Fuel your hustle at closercoffeeco.com. That's closercoffeeco.com. Look for the green logo. Let's get into the first headline here, Joshua. We're talking about personal consumption expenditure rose into 2.7%. Fed's favorite inflation gauge confirms stalling progress. So the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation measure was up 2.7% from a year earlier in March. Data showed on Friday confirming stubborn price growth might be harder to tame than the central bank and markets previously expected. So I guess personal consumption expenditure price index rose 0.3% in March. The Bureau of Economic Analysis reported Friday that continues a pattern of increases seen so far this year. The metric rose 0.4% in January and 0.3% in February. Okay, to put it in simple lay terms, this just means that interest rates will do...
They'll stay higher for longer.
Yep, so mortgage interest rates are going to stay higher. You're not going to see any reprieve in that, at least not yet.
Yeah, it's just not mortgages, though. This is everything. This affects everything in everybody's everyday life. Credit card interest rates, personal loan interest rates. Everything that has an interest rate tied to it is going to be higher for longer. If you're looking to buy a car, you're saving up to finance your first car out there, you know, you're going to pay a higher interest rate than you would have prior to the inflation just running wild in this country.
Yeah, so I guess these are just personal expenditures, personal consumption expenditures. This doesn't include gasoline or food.
Yeah, because they're a lot more volatile. It's hard for them to forecast those items into it. They're just, you know, we talked about it. Gasoline and milk prices, they change daily. You can drive by a gas station in one area of your city and see one price and drive by another one and it's higher or lower. It all changes daily.
Yeah, so this is just indicating that people continue to spend money on everything and anything from restaurants to Amazon to Home Depot to...
Well,
is that what this is all about?
Yeah, but you know, the thing that was most interesting about this report, the key takeaway for it all, was personal savings rate had declined to only 3.2%.
That means they're spending everything that they got.
That means that it's at the lowest level it's been since October of 22, which is a key. Like these interest rate hikes are taking hold and they're taking that extra money out of people's bank accounts that they would normally have. And, you know, what it means is essentially that there are families that are running maybe paycheck to paycheck now. And there's going to be families who are going to be coming up short paycheck to paycheck now. So those are the big key things to look at. And your big companies, big corporations, especially financial corporations, they're looking at this number and they're saying this isn't good. And there are a lot of people who are saying that where we are with inflation right now, the only way to get this back on a downward trend is to start cutting into the labor market, job losses. And interestingly enough, we're actually going to see the jobs report come out this Friday. And probably for one of the first times in many years that I can remember, I had a buyer client tell me that they were putting their home search on hold due to job uncertainty.
I know the tech industry was got hit pretty hard, I think, earlier this year.
Yes.
I think some of your social giants and other tech industries laid off a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And the thing, you know, when we go back, we talk about the how they don't include food and fuel. The funny thing is fuel costs and food costs are one of the driving factors of why people have less savings or everyday cost of living items. I mean, look, man, everybody's seen it every time they go to a restaurant. What used to be a $50 meal is now a $100 meal.
Yep.
You know, what used to be a $12 a couple value meals at your local fast food joint is now a $30.
Yes.
You know, so I think everybody is feeling it. They can't save as much, so savings are dwindling. Not only that, cost of housing is up. It's going to continue to be higher for the long haul. So those who are out there going to be seeking a mortgage, if they're looking for a reprieve, maybe, you know, this summer or something like that, doesn't look like it's going to happen at all.
Yeah, right now there's a lot of economists who think that maybe there's hope for a June interest rate cut.
June?
I've always said I never seen it coming that early in the year. I mean, there were many economists who thought it was going to be in March, and then March has come and gone, and now they're saying, oh, it's going to be June, and they're holding out hope that it's going to be in June. I don't think that that's going to happen. In fact, we'll be looking this Wednesday at 2 p.m. You got the Fed report coming out, and then the press release on Wednesday at 2:30. So there's going to be two pieces of information I'll be looking to digest once they come out. But I don't think that we're going to see interest rate cuts coming to the third quarter at the very earliest. I've always said that since last year. I hold to it. And I also start to think that we may not see three. We may be lucky to get one or two at this point.
Now, I think interest rates are going to go beyond 8% at this point, just what it seems like. I think we might see it by the end of the summer.
I think so. Yeah. I think that, and you know, with the way all the reports are coming out, I think that there's going to be a lot more uncertainty that happens. I mean, even just this week, you know, this past week, the U.S. Treasury auctioned off $183 billion worth of bonds, which was its largest offering ever. One of its largest offerings ever. And you know, what happens with bonds is when they're auctioning them off, the yields tend to go up. And when yields tend to go up, so do mortgage rates. They go up with the yields.
Yeah. So, that's not the 10-year.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And so, you know, you could start to see this being priced in probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. You could start seeing higher interest rates based off of the amount of bonds, the government debt that was just auctioned off this past week. So, you know, sometimes investors are looking for the for sure money, which is the bonds, the government-backed bonds. And sometimes they're feeling risky and they're going to back other investments. Well, now it's probably going to be a little bit more expensive to back those investments into real estate or other expenditures.
Mm.
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about the jobs, right?
Yeah.
We said, you know, a lot of economists are talking about that they don't see interest rates starting to correct and inflation starting to correct until the job market starts to show signs of weakness, and it needs to weaken some in order for these things to take place. So recently, what's come under fire is the initial jobs claims. It's like, for if you take out Easter and one other holiday that was in there for like the last 11 weeks, it's been 212,000 initial jobless claims every week.
Initial jobless claims. People are reporting that they lost their job. Is that what that means?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought it meant.
But. And so it's like 212,000 every week consistently for the last 11 weeks with two fluctuations in there in in a market that we're in right now and an economy that we're in, as robust as it is, you would not expect to see 9 out of 11 reports at 212,000 initial jobless claims. It's too rehearsed, if you will.
You know, it was earlier this year. Was it earlier this year or late last year where they consistently kept talking about a screaming hot jobs market over and over and over again? I don't see that in the news as much, where people are talking about the job market being just on fire.
Well, it was at the beginning of the year, and after the February, I think, 3rd report, interest rates went screaming. Mm-hmm. And we got another jobs report on Friday. So we got the initial jobless claims on Thursday, job report on Friday. It's going to be one of those key things that, you know, depending on how this report comes out, on top of everything else the economy's throwing at us right now, if the jobs report comes out hot on Friday this week, you could see interest rates go over to 8.
Again. Yep.
Yep. You could see them jump over to 8, and that'll just be that catalyst that, forces it to go higher. Just based off of everything that we already know. So that's going to be another key thing this week that I'm going to be following and I'm going to be looking for, is that job report. And then on Tuesday, we got the Case-Shiller and FHFA house pricing index, that's going to come out and show us, you know, what the trend is on home prices. Are they going up? Are they staying the same? Or are they going down? I think some areas you're going to see there's going to be some cooling off in some areas. I think there's going to be other areas where it's still going to remain hot. It's going to be in those most desirable areas with, you know, the best access to, you know, work and leisure. I think those areas are going to remain strong. Some of the other areas, they're probably going to cool off. They're going to go down.
Mm. Well, no good news. In other news, though, UWM, United Wholesale Mortgage, we talked about Matt Ishbia, I think, a couple podcasts ago.
Sure did.
And I guess he has this shell company, allegedly, U Mortgage. It's under attack for alleged shell scheme, I guess. So a report released on April 25th by the hedge-funded media company alleges UWM, United Wholesale Mortgage, set up a shell company called U Mortgage. Just weeks after allegations against United Wholesale Mortgage were published in an expose-style report and a class-action lawsuit, Hunter Brook Media is once again putting the Michigan lender under the spotlight. On Thursday, the hedge-funded media company published its latest report, UWM's Shell Game, how United Wholesale Mortgage executives helped create an independent company that has sent UWM an estimated $1.9 billion in loans, alleging UWM's chief strategy officer, Alex Elizage, I'm butchering that name, set up a shell company used to purchase and establish U Mortgage in 2019. The financing via the shell company, which Elizage owned until at least 2020, allowed Anthony Casa to buy U Mortgage and become its CEO 2 years after he exited personal bankruptcy. Hunter Brook claims that U Mortgage, which operates in 48 states and the District of Columbia, acted as a reliable funnel of loans to UWM, the report read. Elizage appeared on U Mortgage's filings in 2020 until 2020, when it appears that he transferred his stake to Casa just before UWM's public listing through the SPAC transaction. So I guess billions of dollars in loans just funneling to UWM.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the biggest, even though $1.9 billion jumps off the page at you, it also cited that 77% of all of the mortgages that went through U Mortgage went to UWM over a 3-year period of time. Now, the data that we don't have in front of us, right, and this is going to be something that it's going to be for whoever's litigating this thing to figure out. But, you know, we had our good friend Jeremy Berrios on here, and he kind of explained to us that while a lot of these mortgage brokers say they have 250-some lenders that they shop your interest rates around to, a lot of them, their first stop is UWM. So it's going to be hard for them to prove that it was essentially a shell game that they're claiming, the allegations say, because if they go and they look at other mortgage brokers, right, and then let's just say Nexa Mortgage, because we know their company. let's just say that 77% of Nexa mortgages went to UWM. Well, now it's kind of hard to say that, you know, that this was a shell, because if the majority of all the broker loans are going to UWM and not to PennyMac, NewRez, and these other companies that these lenders have, these mortgage brokers have access to, then you could make the argument that it's not necessarily a shell game. It's just that they had the best pricing.
But, well, I'm going to put tinfoil hat on real quick, okay? So it also goes on to say, U Mortgage former branch manager, senior loan originator for U Mortgage, Lindsey Johnson, told Hunter Brook that U Mortgage's leadership allegedly manipulates its rate sheets to make UWM's loans appear cheaper than those from other lenders without telling U Mortgage loan originators whose responsibility it is to shop for the best deal on behalf of clients. Additionally, Johnson claimed that U Mortgage often charges more upfront fees than a traditional broker and pushes home buyers to UWM over other lenders. So if that's what was the case, with they're manipulating these rate sheets, when the mortgage broker is shopping around trying to find the best deal for the client, and UWM keeps popping up, it sounds to me that they're manipulating some sort of data set so that United Wholesale Mortgage appears to be the best deal at all times, but still charges more upfront fees than other lenders. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, that's exactly what it said. And it said that even the loan officers who were working, you know, the loans, just they weren't aware of it.
All right. Well, here's the tin foil comes in. Remember when we had Phil here?
Yeah.
And with Nexa Mortgage, and he was talking about, you know, UWM. They talked about that. Is it possible that they're doing the same shit with other lenders?
100%. I mean, because, you know, if you talk to a lot of mortgage brokers, they 100%, they adamantly believe that this is the best place to go to broker loans. And
is it? But is it? Something being manipulated that's what the
report says. That's what the allegations are. The allegations are that they manipulate the rate sheets in order to make it appear that they are the best. Now, if I'm a mortgage broker and I'm reviewing the numbers every day between UWM and 249 or 251 other mortgage brokers, and I consistently get the best numbers from this company, I don't know that it's been manipulated. I'm just looking at the numbers. I take my client, I run the file. This is the best one. I'm immediately going with it. There is a possibility that in the software system that it was manipulating the rate sheets and making loan officers believe that this was the absolute best deal for that client.
I guess. Is it some sort of aggregator that they have or something that just pulls it all together?
I'm not 100% sure, and I don't want to speculate on how somebody's doing it.
We got to get mortgage broker.
I don't even think he could help either, because essentially what this report is alleging is, you know, it borders along criminal activity in the sense that
it would be mortgage fraud, wouldn't it? I'm not a lawyer or anything,
yes,
but
it borders along that, and so it would be very hard for us to speculate on how somebody is doing criminal activity, but essentially, it's saying that there's some type of software that they use to adjust the rate sheets, and the loan officer essentially goes to their client and says, hey, this is the best deal that we got right here. In comparison to all the other 249, 250 other people I could take your loan to, this is the best one based off the data that's in front of me.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not this is truly manipulation on every level, I don't know that they are at that level of like world domination. However, his speech clearly indicated that he's on like world domination level. Maybe he manipulated everybody. Maybe the system manipulated everybody involved.
Who's Rocket Mortgage CEO? Do you know?
Oh man, I forget his name. Now that you asked me.
Well, whoever his name is, he's got to be laughing his ass off right now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's got to be loving this.
He owns one of the basketball teams. Is it
I don't know.
Yeah, he owns one of the basketball teams as well. And then Matt Ishbia went and bought the Phoenix Suns.
And he owns the WNBA team that nobody watches. What is that, Mercury?
I'm trying to figure out. The name Rob Johnson sounds familiar to me for a second, but I'm not 100% sure that that's who it is.
Right, let's look it up real quick. Dan Gilbert.
Dan Gilbert. That's there the name that Jeremy said. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Dan Gilbert. So he's got to be laughing.
Yeah. And I think he owns a basketball team, like the Pistons or somebody.
Okay, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's rich.
But exactly, he would be laughing because, you know, as we've talked about in the past, UWM made a lot of these mortgage brokers sign agreements that, hey, you're either going to work exclusively with us or we're not going to do your loans. They did
kind of like no compete clauses.
Yeah, they did want to compete with Rocket Mortgage, which then also tends to say, how could any broker who's only brokering the loans through UWM and not Rocket Mortgage, who is their near peer
competitor?
Yeah, that's your closest peer to what you do in size and volume. And if you're not offering both parties, then you technically cannot say that this is the best mortgage that's possible. You can say it's the best of what's available to me.
Yeah.
But you can't tell your clients that you're getting them the best possible deal whenever you don't have the next biggest competitor quoting that loan.
Yeah. Well, interesting. We'll keep everybody updated as this story unfolds and we see what the disposition of all this was, but I hope really that that's not no funny games going on.
Well, I mean, so if it is, you're going to start seeing a lot more regulation come in, you know, into mortgages, home loans, all those things.
I mean, they're already talking about eliminating discount points, which are the essentially helps mortgage companies generate a profit margin. So
yes, but, you know, depending on how the regulation goes and how strict it goes, because you're talking about the largest mortgage broker company in the United States. So regulations that are levied against them will affect the whole entire mortgage broker side of the industry.
Yeah.
So you could have some significant consequences with this. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, the investors who are investing in these products are Wall Street backed. Mm. So they're buying the mortgages afterwards as part of MBSs was the old, I don't know if they're still calling them MBSs. I think they're called CDOs now. But, you know, there's a lot at stake here for a lot of people on a lot of different levels, including the consumers as well.
Yeah. Well, what do we got else? We have Biden.
Good friend Biden.
Old Joe Biden. This guy, I'm convinced that this guy hates real estate and hates entrepreneurship. I'm thinking he's just totally against it. And Biden capital gains proposal of 44.6%. So this is according to Forbes. Much has been made of President Joe Biden's proposal in the fiscal year 2025 budget of the United States government to raise capital gains rates. The number being bandied about is 44.6%, which would be the highest formal federal capital gains rate since its inception. That rate comes with many caveats and asterisks. Okay, let me see the caveats here. The source of the 44.6% rate is a footnote from the general explanation of the administration's FY fiscal year 2025 revenue proposal. And it reads, in relevant part, a separate proposal would first raise the top ordinary rate to 39.6%. It later adds an additional proposal, a second one, I guess, would increase the net investment income tax rate by 1.2 percentage points above 400,000. Additionally, together, the proposal would increase the top marginal rate on long-term capital gains and qualified dividends to 44.6%. Now, dividends are talking about stocks, portfolios, and stuff like that.
Yep.
Okay. And that additional proposal, the secondary proposal, would increase net investment income tax rate by 1.2 points above 400,000. Now, 400,000 a year is what you have to make in your annual income, or is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
It's not that much.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, but like you would think, because they keep talking about the top 1%, millionaires and billionaires. When I say $400,000 a year, I don't think millionaires and billionaires.
No.
No. I think like working professionals, yes. Like doctors or yes. lawyers or yes. something like that. Let's see. What is it? The main proposal, which lends context to the above mentioned separate proposal, is to raise the long-term capital gains qualified dividends rate to 37% for taxpayers with taxable income above $1 million. Okay. Taken as a whole, then, the 44.6% rate would only come to fruition under a separate proposal. Now we got three?
Yep.
From the Biden administration's main capital gains rate increase, and only apply to those individuals with taxable income above $1 million, okay, so you got to have at least $1 million, and investment income above $400,000. So when it says investment income, does that mean you got $400,000 worth of stock?
Yeah, or real estate.
Or real estate. Mm-hmm. Ooh. That isn't quite a cataclysmic a policy shift as referring to a blanket 44.6% long-term capital gains rate, which suggests the presentation of the 45% capital gains rate proposal is a strategic policy maneuver, loudly shouting a startlingly high percentage while mutely ignoring the crucial aspect of income thresholds. The intent appears to be to play on public sentiments and concerns, more specifically the political landmine of adverse outcomes of small business owners. At base, such tactics to obscure the fact that Okay.
Look, at the end of the day, it's exactly what we said before.
It sounds confusing as shit. Yeah,
but it's exactly what we said before, man. This is nothing more than a political play. Real estate is one of the hottest topics and has been one of the hottest topics of his presidency. So therefore, if you're going to try to make a last-ditch effort stand, I think, you told me his approval rating stands somewhere around
something like 42%.
42%. If you're going to make a last ditch effort to try to say, hey, I've done something during my time here, then it's going to be real estate is that hot button issue. And it's like, you know, one of the other things that's buried in here that you didn't even get to, but it's buried in here is
somewhere in those layers.
1031 exchanges. And here was the quote, and I'm just going to give you the short synopsis of it. It eliminates tax subsidies and for real estate. The budget closes the like-kind exchange loophole, a special tax subsidy for real estate. This loophole lets real estate investors, but not investors in any other asset, put off paying taxes on profits from deals indefinitely as long as they keep investing in real estate. This amounts to an indefinite interest-free loan on government. Real estate is the only asset that gets the sweetheart deal. That's exactly what it says from the White House fact sheet on this proposal. They call it the real estate sweetheart deal. If that isn't any more of an indicator that they are coming at and attacking the real estate industry, I don't know what else is.
So the reason why a lot of investors use a 1031 exchange is after you sell a property, you're not going to take all that money and go buy a Lamborghini. You're going to take that and you're going to reinvest it into the next one. You're going to hire a bunch of people to come in there and do work for you, maybe, or if you're going to do a short-term investment. But if you're going to do a long-term, then you're providing another place for somebody to rent or you know, hire a property management company or something like that. Well, you're hiring people to run this operation. So why are they going to – the reason why they didn't tax that, to my understanding, is so that the person continues to reinvest over and over again. So they don't want people to invest over and over again?
It's ironic because, like, two episodes ago, we talked about the tax credit. Yeah. That they're going to give investors. So this is why I say this is really just it's a political play because it's a hot button topic. It gets a lot of attention in America right now. So on one hand, you're saying, hey, investors, I'm going to introduce this bill that's going to allow you to get a 35% tax credit if you just keep investing in real estate, fixing up dilapidated buildings and making them new and making them livable again. But on the same token, I'm not going to allow you to use the 1031 exchange that you've been using for however many years to rebuild dilapidated houses in America to make sure that there is housing available in the United States. So it's like, it's just a bunch of things just thrown at the wall, and it's like, hey, let's just see what's going to stick, and let's see what is going to get us the attention that we need in order to, you know, politically win the political war.
But this administration can't be this stupid. Like, okay, we're going to tax the hell out of your gains so you can't reinvest it, and you can't take advantage of my tax credit that I'm going to give. So
no, that's exactly what it is.
And it doesn't chip away at the 7 million home deficit in the United States. And if anything, it's going to increase it and make it worse.
No, that's exactly what it is. Actually, what it is they increase the capital gains taxes to an amount that is more, that is higher, that makes you rehabbing houses a little bit less advantageous to rehab it and take the profits with the 44% capital gains tax. But if you do X amount of them over here and you take the 35% tax credit over here on 5 or 10 houses, well, then you don't have to worry as much on the capital gains taxes over here or the 44%. So when you add the two of them together, if all things being equal, you end up coming out somewhere around, I don't know, 9% taxes. Because you're using 35% tax credits in order to offset the 44% on the rest of them.
Yeah, but then you got to flip another house and you got to sell it cheaper.
Yes.
Yeah, and so, it'd take all that risk.
It's very, very convoluted.
That was stupid. I would never do that. I don't think you would do that.
No,
either.
I would. But this is, so they initially came out with their tax credit, right? People push back and said, hey, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Most people who are flipping houses are not going to be, they're not going to be interested in your 35% tax credit, right? Mm-hmm. So the only way to get people to be interested in is, well, we got to jack up the capital gains tax. Because if we jack up the capital gains tax, then it makes the 35% tax credit advantageous for investors to go after. But however, like you said, no, what you're going to end up doing is stifling investing in real estate. And we cannot afford a stiflement in real estate with a 7 million home shortage in this country.
Nah, these people aren't the brightest. The people that are leading our country and making our money. I mean, look at the national debt. What are we at? 36 trillion, 34 trillion?
Somewhere up there.
It's such an astronomical number. Nobody can even fathom that amount. But these are the people in charge of making policies.
But you know what, though? So. Like, there are everyday, like, people who are using the 1031 exchange to say, hey, I want to, you know, I bought this house, but I'm just going to go buy another house. I haven't lived in it long enough in order to, you know, avoid the capital gains taxes, but I'm just looking to move up. You know, it's a like kind. That's the reason why the rule says like kind. You know, if I bought a house at, you know, $250,000 and I'm ready to sell that and just go, you know, buy another house, I'm upsizing into something that is more of what my lifestyle may, you know, require. And I just haven't, you know, lived in it that long to avoid capital gains taxes. I just use a 1031 exchange, go buy another house at $400,000 that's suitable for my family that's now growing. And I don't have to pay any capital gains taxes.
Yeah.
So now it's essentially taking that away from everyday people as well.
Yeah. Because what they want to do is a 1031 is they would purchase another property within 60 days, right? Is that the limit, 60 days?
Yeah. They have to, it's 180 days, but then there's like you have to have a contract on it within 60 days and close on it within like 90 days thereafter. So it is, there's definitive timelines, and we could get a 1031 person on here to explain a little bit better, but. And it would be good to get their take on who's using this thing more or less.
Because the strategy was to do a 1031, buy yourself something like a rental or something, and then do a cash out refinance, 70 to 30 LTV loan to value. And that way, instead of paying 30% on taxes to the government, you got a free rental property out of it, and you got your cash back in the form of a debt, because mm-hmm. You don't pay taxes on debt, you pay taxes on income.
Yes. So, but there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Little strategies. There's
in this proposal,
yeah.
There's a whole lot of things in here that, you know, are just really going to affect a lot of people, in the sense that there is one proposal in there that doesn't allow for you to transfer essentially your wealth that you've gained over time to your family after you've deceased. So it's basically they're cutting out a lot of the, like, passing on of generational wealth,
yeah.
is what it is.
Yeah.
So that's coming under attack in this as well.
So, but that's all I got, man.
Yeah.
All right, guys, if you like this video, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. Go ahead and give us a like. Comment below. Let us know what you think about Biden's 44% or UWM, Mr. Matt Ishbia, or what you think about these interest rates going forward. With that, thanks for watching. See you soon.